Well, you've heard the old expression, hindsight is 20/20. We can look back and, okay, we can plug in the names now, and it's easy to figure out this puzzle. So this wasn't really written for Daniel. If you think about it, who was this written for? Well, Daniel went to his grave scratching his head, I think, about this. This was written for our benefit, for our knowledge and our learning, that we might believe and that our faith might be enhanced.
The Bible says that the gospel of Christ is the power of God unto salvation. Welcome to Pulpit Power, featuring Pastor Tony Skeving, Senior Pastor of Fargo Baptist Church in Fargo, North Dakota. Today's message was previously preached before a church audience. And now, here's Pastor Skeving.
Well, let's take our Bibles, please, at this time and turn to the book of Daniel in the 11th chapter. Daniel chapter 11. I'm sure we all remember those skirmishes as little kids where somebody does you dirty and you say, I'll get you for that, Timmy, or I'll get you for that, Susie. And there's kind of a code of revenge built into the human heart, isn't there? However, that little boy and that little girl grow up and you find as adults and even at the national level, there's still that eye for an eye and that tooth for a tooth kind of a philosophy. And that's what we find here in Daniel chapter 11. We find two nations, the north and the south, basically Syria and Egypt, going at it in a time period somewhere between the second and the third century BC. And it's a ton of tit for tat. It's a going back and forth, kind of a feud like the Hatfields and the McCoys. And you find in each case, they go back at it after a battle has been fought and won, to get revenge or to wipe out some dishonor from a previous battle. It's kind of a cultural thing. And there are still some proud nations like that, kind of hot-headed nations, if you will, that have it in their culture. Now, none of that really matters so much as how this affected Israel. Because remember, this is Gabriel telling Daniel the future of his people. So the bigger picture here is how this all affected Israel or touched Israel. And the eye of heaven, I've said this many times, is on the nation of Israel. Now, we find here in chapter 11, I think somewhere around 45 verses, and so we've got a ways to go, but chapter 12 is short. Chapter 11 is the heaviest prophecy chapter of the whole book. In fact, one of the heaviest prophecy chapters in the whole Bible. And we find here really some things that are written in riddles. I'll just be honest with you. There is no way Daniel understood what Gabriel was telling him here. And unless somehow I'm wrong, we get to heaven and he says, no, God was showing it to me as Gabriel gave it to me. But I'm picturing this 90-some-year-old man there. He's scratching his head and the angel is telling about some things that are going to befall his people. And Daniel just couldn't begin to plug in the names of these people like we are doing. We know exactly who it's talking about here with incredible detail. But how is it that we understand it and Daniel didn't? Well, you've heard the old expression. Hindsight is 20/20. We can look back and, okay, we can plug in the names now. And it's easy to figure out this puzzle. So this wasn't really written for Daniel. If you think about it, who was this written for? Well, Daniel went to his grave scratching his head, I think, about this. This was written for our benefit, for our knowledge and our learning, that we might believe and that our faith might be enhanced. I read in 1 Corinthians 10:11, now these things are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. Do you think you're living in the end times? I do. So I think God put this in here for us, and God foretold all of this stuff that was going to happen 200-300 years later for our benefit so that we could see how the Bible works and that we could trust our Bible. And we would have a faith built on the Bible, because if God said it would happen, and it did, then we can look at some things yet to happen and say, well, you know, if it happened before, it'll happen again. So we also find that this helps us to believe things like the rapture, the tribulation period, the millennial kingdom, a mansion in heaven. You know, we read those things and go, wow, that's kind of far-fetched. But no, there's no question about it. That's how specific and accurate the Bible is. By the way, as we study this, we also find God's style in giving prophecy, the wording of things and the symbolic things that are used there to help us to understand stuff. And so there's a lot of benefit to see how accurate the Bible is and how specific the Bible is. You know, Christ said this in Matthew 5, for verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. And so I'm going to tell you right up front, God writes in riddles here in chapter 11. And you say, why doesn't he just spell it out plainly so that we'll dig it out, so that we'll study, right? Doesn't the Bible also say, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth? And so God wants us to be interested in him and seek it out and be curious about this. We're curious by nature, aren't we? I mean, we have everything right here at our fingertips. I don't know about you. I'm always asking questions and learning stuff and figuring things out. And I'm curious by nature. And I think there's no greater curiosity than this book, because God is interesting. God is limitless. God is inexhaustible. And I think when we investigate the things of God, it's pleasing unto him. And so let's do that here, shall we? We've looked at the Ptolemies, we've looked at the Seleucuses, we've looked at the Antiochuses, and we've looked at the Bernices and covered a lot of new names here. Now, we're coming up to the name Cleopatra. Now, that resonates with you, but I'll just tell you right up front, it's not the one you're thinking about, all right? It's not Liz Taylor. No, just kidding. It's not the one that was actually, you know, just a few decades prior to the time of Christ. Get the time period here. We're about 200 years before that time. And there were several Cleopatras at that time. And so we pick it up in verse 11. We're going to actually read to verse 20, and I'm hoping to cover that much today. It's a lot. But in verse number 11, it says, "And the king of the south," now that's Ptolemy the fourth, "shall be moved with choler or anger," hot under the collar, remember, "and shall come forth and fight with him," even with the king of the north. Now that's Antiochus the third, and he's the guy we're going to be talking about the most today. It says, "And he," that is the king of Syria, Antiochus the third, "shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his," that is Ptolemy the fourth's, "hand." So Egypt's going to win this battle. "And when he," that is Ptolemy the fourth, Philopater, "hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also, the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to exalt or establish the vision, but they shall fall." That was a parenthetical verse that took place during that time. I explained that last time. So really you leapfrog from verse 13 to verse 15. "So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he," that's Antiochus, "that cometh against him," that's Ptolemy, "shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land," what do you think that is, "which by his hand shall be consumed. He," Antiochus the third, "shall also set his face to enter into the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him, thus shall he do, and he shall give him," that's Ptolemy the fifth, more about that guy in a moment, "the daughter of women," that's Cleopatra, "corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. After this, he," still Antiochus the third, "shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf." Now we're starting to see Rome. "Shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found." Here's where we're going to stop. "Then shall stand up in his estate, a raiser of taxes and the glory of the kingdom. But within few days, he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle." Now, I hope we get through all this, but let's just back up here. Ptolemy the fourth had won the last battle. He was the playboy. We talked about him. And normally battles were fought outside of the capital, outside of the population, somewhere out in the wilderness, but in the vicinity of the side that's been attacked. And so you wanted to meet the army away from the citizens, away from the buildings. And if the visiting team won, could I just put it that way? They marched into the capital and they spoiled the capital. But here's Ptolemy the fourth, he wins the battle, and he should have marched into Syrian's capital. The Syrians retreated back to Syria, but Ptolemy didn't follow. Instead, notice he focused on the hostages that he had taken. Verse 12 says, and when he, that's Ptolemy, the fourth Philopater, the playboy, hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. What's that mean? Well, he was proud of this victory he'd won. He really didn't have any knowledge as a statistician, as a general, as a military leader. He had men that did that. He just liked the fact he had an army under his control. It was like a toy to him. And so here he is, proud of the victory and all giddy. And the Bible tells us here that something happened with the hostages, if I could call them POWs. He has them put to death. It mentions they will be cast down. He was actually an eccentric guy and a weird guy and a little bit out of it. But he wins the battle. He gets rid of the POWs. And then he goes back to Egypt to his wine and his women and his song and his playboy life. He preferred the bottle to the battle. And that's this Ptolemy here. So he goes back to his harem in Egypt. And in verse number 12, it says he was not strengthened by this battle. And so he kind of, instead of finishes off the north, he just goes back and he parties hardy. Well, from that point on, there's peace for the next 12 years. And you know why there was peace for 12 years? Because they made a peace treaty. There was no war between Egypt and Syria for 12 years because they had this peace treaty now that they'd finally made between them. You think that would last? Has any peace treaty ever lasted? The only thing we learn from history is peace treaties don't work, never have worked, because there's war in the human heart. It's just a matter of time. We need to understand from history that those nations are going to be suspicious of each other and keep doing stuff behind the scene. You know, we have a nation right now currently under attack from Russia, right? I think we all are familiar with that war. And that war has decimated and destroyed the people of Ukraine. And sadly, this goes back to 1992. A lot of people don't realize that Ukraine signed the Lisbon Protocol. And for the next 2 years, they spent time disarming, giving away their nukes. Before that time, they were the third most powerful. As far as nuclear weapons go, they had the third most nuclear weapons in the world. When the Ukraine disarmed, the U.S. and the U.K. guaranteed protection known as the Budapest Memorandum. So in other words, if there's an issue, we're there. Well, knowing the depraved nature of human beings, the only deterrent from somebody coming after you is a bigger gun than they have. That's the bottom line. That's all we understand. It's a matter of time, and history has shown this over and over and over again. Peace treaties do not work, and America has signed plenty in the past. And we're all giddy. Like, oh, we got a peace treaty here. You know, hauntingly enough, America is not really mentioned in Old Testament prophecy. And everybody says, well, what's going to happen to our nation? Well, we could be Revelation chapter 18, a nation that falls in a day, a rich nation that really made the whole world prosperous, something compared to Babylon, which was a cosmopolitan, a melting pot of various cultures like we are. Could we be Revelation 18? I don't know, but it falls in a day. And so we find a 12-year peace treaty signed between Syria and Egypt, and that brings us to verse 13. Does it work? Nope. It says, for the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. So all he does, Syria and Antiochus III amass a bigger army than they had 12 years earlier. And they totally ignored the peace treaty. In fact, as soon as it was signed, they began training their boys. They began building up a massive arsenal, weapons and all that. They were a stubborn bunch of Arabs, and they focused on revenge. It's kind of a remember the Alamo battle cry here. Let's get them back here. So they raised their teens and preteen boys to be warriors and to go back after the Egyptian. Now, in the previous battle, it consisted of about 30,000 Syrian soldiers. But we find in verse number 13, it says, for the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former. Here's Gabriel telling Daniel, it's going to be a bigger army. This was hundreds of years beforehand. And it was a bigger multitude than before. Instead of 30,000, it was 70,000. And the way that Syria was able to amass such a huge army is they hired the army or borrowed the army of Philip V, the Macedonian. And I think we've all heard of Hessian soldiers, basically, that hire themselves out for war. And so here's Antiochus III. He's going to make sure he wins this battle. And the army of Syria descends down south, and it, on the way, plunders Israel, as always, and it spoils the Jews. In other words, gets a bunch of stuff from them. That's how they would finance the army of Philip V. And by the way, the reason that Palestine, as it's known, is always in the way of a battle, and it's such a precious, precious strip of land, a little strip of land, is it joins three continents together. It joins Europe together, joins Africa together, joins Asia together. And it's no wonder everybody in the world wants it. It's valuable by the square foot, no less. And so these two armies, they continually pass through it. And we find here that Syria is headed up by Antiochus III. We've talked about him. He invades Egypt. And the year is about 203 BC. That brings us up to the timeline. Daniel is getting this prophecy prior to 500 BC, so about 300 years earlier. God's pinpointing what's going to happen. So it's 203 BC. Why that time? Why did Antiochus III in Syria determine at that time they were going to attack Egypt? Well, it was a good time to invade Egypt. Egypt was vulnerable because Ptolemy IV, remember the playboy? Ptolemy IV had died by this point, and he had left the kingdom to his son, Ptolemy V, who was 7 years old. Do we have any 7-year-olds in here today? I don't know if they're out in their own class right now. But what's the result? As a result of this, we pick it up in verse 15. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities. And the arms of the south, that's Egypt, shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he, Antiochus III, that cometh against him, Ptolemy V, the boy, shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Now, here's what happened. Instead of that battle taking place down in Egypt, the Egyptians had holed up in the Egyptian or in the Israeli cities, fenced cities. And so here they are, held up in these Jewish cities, and Syria comes down, and to get them out, they cast the mount up. And we talked about that, remember? I showed you that picture of Masada and how that battle took place. So they would make a ramp to get into a walled city, and so they cast the mount against these fenced cities, and it mentions the glorious land. So this battle, historians tell us, did take place in Israel. And the Syrians won. The Syrians took them down. And the Jews, as a result, it's this point right here, mark this point, that the Jews took sides with the Syrians. That would be a fatal mistake. Notice in verse number 17, it says, he, that is Antiochus III, shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. That's speaking of the Jews. That's some of that terminology I mentioned. They're going to side with him. Thus shall he do, and shall give him, now we're going to talk about that in a moment, Ptolemy V, the daughter of women. So God tells us in advance, hundreds of years before, what's going to happen. You say, is that big a deal? Let me just say this. If you could foretell one day in advance what's going to happen, you would be the richest man in the world. Did you know that? If you could just tell tomorrow what's going to happen, you would be filthy rich. If you could just foretell on Sunday what's going to happen Monday, imagine the investing you could do when the bell rings at the New York Stock Exchange and Wall Street. Imagine the betting you could do in Las Vegas and the horse racetrack. And I'm not advising you to do all this stuff, but imagine you'd have money coming out of your ears. Nations would be flocking to you to find out what's going to happen politically next. Like I mentioned Ukraine a moment ago. Imagine if we could have foretold Pearl Harbor the day before. I mean, if you had the ability to just do it for one day in advance. So let's never get used to this. This is a big deal. This is God telling hundreds of years beforehand what's going to happen. Now, here's Antiochus III. Back to this guy. He is the dad of the Cleopatra we're going to be talking about in verse number 17. And Antiochus III, after winning this battle, he studied history. And he has seen that the seesaw battle between Egypt and Syria has been going on since the days, basically, of the kingdom splitting under Alexander the Great. So this tit-for-tat thing, basically it caused a lot of bloodshed. And so he says, you know what, it's time to figure out a different way to make peace between us. He wanted to go down in history as the Syrian king who brought this thing to a close and settled it once and for all. And so he decided, and it wasn't a good plan, it was a devious one, he decided in a plan how to do in Egypt once and for all. They had been battling back and forth since the four-way split during the days of Alexander the Great. So there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a backdoor way, something undetected, an approach, enough bloodshed. It's not solving anything. And so on the throne of Egypt at this time, we have Ptolemy the Fifth, Epimenes. He was just a kid. Now in verse 17, it says, he, Antiochus the Third, shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him, Ptolemy the Fifth, the daughter of women, Cleopatra, corrupting her. Now we'll talk about that. First of all, we find the upright ones mentioned in verse 17. And by the way, if you haven't caught this yet, Gabriel has a way of using colloquial terms here to describe the Jewish people. They're the upright ones. They're the righteous ones. They're the holy ones. It's a glorious land, the chosen people, the pleasant land. And so we find these terms and they mean the Jews and Israel. So they're called here the upright ones. And verse 17 tells us they throw their hat in with Antiochus III. Now the year is 198 BC. We're about 200 years before the birth of Jesus Christ. Verse 17 mentions he, Antiochus the Great, the Third. It says, he also shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he, that's Antiochus the Third, shall give him, that's Ptolemy the Fifth, the daughter of women. This is Cleopatra. It's another arranged marriage between a 7-year-old Cleopatra, and at this point, a 7-year-old Ptolemy the Fifth. But notice those words, corrupting her. History tells us he had corrupted his daughter, made her devious and diabolical, and coached her. And by the way, even the ungodly crowd out there today knows that youth is the best time to cement in the mind of a young person some philosophy, be it good or bad. I mean, they figured that out. So you have two children, 7 years old, and the Syrian king Antiochus III had trained his daughter Cleopatra to go down to Egypt with a plan. It speaks of him corrupting her. And it's true historically. She was to be deceitful. She was to take in this young man. And by the way, they didn't marry at 7. They waited until they're 12. That's a whole lot better, right? To get married, according to historians. But we find out here, she's going to take this man as her husband or boy and take the kingdom over eventually and hand it to her dad. Now, she's called here the daughter of women. That's a term of eminence here. We would say the first lady. All right. She's going to become the first lady of Egypt. And we find here that Antiochus III intended to use his own daughter down in Egypt to solidify his political clout and bring the whole kingdom to him. She was to grow up, establish herself as queen, and bump off her husband. Basically, poison him, and we saw Laodice did that not too long ago, and then to seize control of the kingdom. Imagine raising a young girl for a mission like that. I mean, could I just see my granddaughter being groomed along for a mission like that in life? I mean, it's hard to fathom. But that's exactly what went on historically, and the Bible tells us it would be coming. However, the plan backfired. Did you catch that in verse number 17? It mentions, notice the word, thus shall he do, in the middle of the verse. And he shall give him, Ptolemy the boy king, the Fifth, the daughter of women, Cleopatra, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. What's that talking about? Well, here's what happened. Cleopatra didn't follow through with the plan. She must have taken a liking to this boy. Puppy love, call it what you want. But as they grew up, the boy won her heart. And she said, I'm not going to do him dirty here. And so she decided to be loyal to her Egyptian husband instead of her devious dad. And by the way, no honor among thieves, is there? I mean, what do you expect from evil people? Have you ever thought what it would be like to be in the mafia and always looking over your shoulder and worried about whether your best friend will take you down? You just never know. And it goes on in the mafia. And in the mafia, God forbid, you're a stool pigeon. I heard of somebody who was caught in the mafia and started to rat on the rest of his buddies. And they call somebody like that a canary when they start singing. And so anyway, this guy turned in his buddies and they were to go to trial. And they had to, of course, hide the witness. And they thought they had him hidden. They had him on the seventh floor of a skyscraper in New York. And somehow the mafia found out about it. And they got in there, they overpowered the guard and threw the guy out the seventh floor. And afterwards they quipped, he was the canary who could sing, but he couldn't fly. And you go, oh, that is rough. And they are rough. There is no honor among thieves. We find here that Cleopatra does her dad dirty. And that's not the first time it's happened. So the wedding took place in 193 BC. And both of these kids at this point are 12 years of age. She's the daughter of women. She's the first lady, the royal princess. And she was introduced to all this deceit at a very early age by, of all people, her own dad. Children are very moldable, for good or bad. Remember that. You know, there are 12-year-olds in gangs that are so hardened. They are privy to murders, execution style, because at that point, they've been molded that way in inner city someplace. It's horrible. At a time when children should be playing with sandlot ball and things like that, they're committing murder. I am so glad my grandkids live in a different world, and the kids here at our church live in a different world. Well, here's Cleopatra, and she's deceitful, she's greedy, she's the pits. She's the opposite of a Christian girl. And by the way, true beauty is in the heart. It's in the heart. So here's Antiochus III. He sacrifices the moral fiber and the character of his daughter, but it backfires. It backfires. Well, Antiochus III never got Egypt, but he did take Israel. Remember that. Israel sided with him, threw their hat into their corner, and mainly because they still resented Egypt. Remember what was brewing after in their heart after hundreds of years. They had been slaves in Egypt all that time. And so now they side with the Syrians, but it is going to backfire because it would be a Syrian king, and he's coming up next, who would become the greatest Old Testament enemy of the Jews. In fact, probably the greatest persecutor of the Jews, along with a Hitler, and along with the Antichrist. Now, how's this going to play out? Well, in verse number 18, it says, after this shall he, that is Antiochus III still, turn his face unto the isles. You can write the word Aegean isles there in your margin if you want. And shall take many. He's taken more property, those Aegean isles. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. So here's Antiochus III again, and he's taking some islands out there in the Aegean Sea as property, and this is all being fulfilled between 196 BC and 187 BC. In 197 BC, Antiochus III wanted to extend his influence, his land. And so he started a fight to conquer the islands of the Aegean Sea along the coast of Asia Minor. At this time, they were under Roman control. Now let's back up. You remember the image of Nebuchadnezzar there? The head was of gold, Babylonian kingdom. We find the chest of silver. That is the Medo-Persian kingdom. We find the midsection, midriff area there of brass. That's Greece. And then we find, of course, that's split up, but we find the legs of iron representing the Roman Empire. And those feet that are partly of iron and clay, that's the revived Roman Empire yet to come during the tribulation period. So we know this. We know eventually Rome is going to have to come on the scene and take over. Well, at this time, roughly about 175 to 200 B.C., Rome is just starting to rise up, flex its muscles. And by the time of Christ, who's in control? Rome, squarely. Who crucified Jesus Christ? It was the Romans. This is the beginning of that. So right around 200 B.C., you've got Rome flexing its muscles, coming up the ranks. And while Syria and Egypt have been fighting back and forth, guess who's building a military machine behind the scenes over in Italy? Goes totally under the radar here. And in verse number 18, it says, "And after this, Antiochus III shall turn his face into the Aegean Isles and shall take many," that is of those isles, "but a prince for his own behalf." Now, who's this? This is a Roman general by the name of Lucius Scipio Agiaticus. Let's just call him Skippy, all right? No. But Scipio here, the one mentioned in verse number 18, is the prince on his own behalf. And he was quite a naval commander. I mean, great battle in that Aegean area was fought against Antiochus III. And Rome soundly defeats the Syrian navy here. And in return, we find that Antiochus III has to give back these Aegean islands and some Asiatic territory. It was humiliating. In fact, he brought great reproach upon himself. That's what's mentioned in verse number 18. It mentions reproach, reproach. Antiochus III had 300 warships, according to historians. And we find that when the battle took place, Rome attacked and sank most of them. They decimated the Syrians, and a lot of lives were lost. It was a humiliating blow, but it didn't stop there. This is what happened. Antiochus III had to surrender, and he had to submit to the terms of Rome. He was called to Rome. This is the dad of Cleopatra. He was called to Rome. And Livy the historian tells us that Rome dealt with Antiochus III very, very harshly. They took away a bunch of land from him. Much of Western Turkey that surrounded Hannibal, there was a lot of other humiliating terms, including a settlement for a lot of money. Something like 15,000 talents of something. It was a huge sum of money. It was more than the Syrians could come up with. Plus, there were some yearly payments that had to be made. So here we find Antiochus III called to Rome, stand before the tribunal, and he's told, "You've got to give us this much money and make installments every year." And to make sure that happened, Rome demanded that 20 relatives of Antiochus III come to Rome and be held hostage there in Rome until the debt was paid. Well, guess who one of them was? This is where it all connects. One of those hostages is Antiochus Epiphanes III. More about him in a moment. But Antiochus IV, the son of Antiochus III, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. When I say Antiochus Epiphanes, you can almost hear that dun-dun-dun music. You know what I mean by that? He's such an evil man. And we're going to be talking loads about him. And really, you almost want to wince when you hear his name. You'll understand the weeks to come. But this is the beginning of the rise of the greatest persecutor of the Jews in the Bible. And next to Hitler and the Antichrist, his life parallels that of the Antichrist so much that he in the Bible is a type or a picture of the Antichrist. So we find in verse 18, after this, Antiochus III shall turn his face toward the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf, that is that Scipio general, shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. That's exactly what happened. So Antiochus III returns back to Syria, defeated, humiliated, huge debt to pay. And he has to send some VIPs back to Rome as hostages until the debt is paid. Well, he's desperate to pay, and he hasn't got the money to pay it. So he goes into the heathen temples there of the north or Syria, and he starts plundering those heathen temples, taking that gold, taking that silver, taking things of value. And notice in verse number 19, it says, "Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land." Now we're going to stop right there and see what happened. He's looting these temples. They're called forts because they basically were built of rock, solid rock, just like the Jewish temple, of his own land. And in order to pay the huge war debt, he's plundering a pagan temple of Baal in Syria when he's murdered. He is stabbed in the back by a guy named Elymais. And in verse number 19, it foretells that. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Gabriel's telling this to Daniel 300 years earlier. And by the way, that's longer than we've been a nation. I mean, that's how long that, since our independence, all right? So Antiochus III is murdered, plundering his own temples. And here's his fate, by the way, written in the Bible. Only he didn't know that was him. It was written long before he was born. I mean, if he could have known that, he could have just said, okay, that's me. But here's his fate, and if he could only deciphered it, maybe he'd have done something different. So what follows? Well, very interesting, and we'll close with verse 20 here. Brings us to about 187 to 185 BC. It says, then shall stand up in his estate, that is Antiochus III, a raiser of taxes. Wonder why he had to raise taxes. In the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. So here's what happened. Antiochus III dies robbing his own pagan temples there in Syria. He leaves behind two sons and one daughter. Remember her name? Cleopatra. All right, we're going to forget her for now and focus on the two sons. One of them is Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He's in Rome as a hostage, right? He's in captivity. But Antiochus III had another son who is known as Seleucus IV Philopater. And he's the one mentioned in verse 20 who's going to be a raiser of taxes. Why did he have to raise taxes? What do you think? Because of that war debt to Rome. So Seleucus turned to the people who had the money to get the money. Guess who they were? The Jews. God's people, chosen people, the Jews, have had a special gift that really goes back to the days of Abraham. And you take this any way you want, but it was Jewish people even that financed the American Revolution. A lot of people don't even know this. Guys like Chaim Soloman, who was a wealthy, wealthy Jewish man who sided with us against the British and died broke as a result of it. It could be much of the freedoms we've enjoyed in this country are due to guys like Chaim Soloman. And so here we find the people, and there's countless stories of this little fraction of people who have prospered monetarily. And here's the Jews. They had the money there. And Seleucus IV goes after that Jewish money. And that's why it says in verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. That's another expression for Israel. It's a hint. Gabriel's talking to Daniel here. And so here's Israel. They've swung their support from Egypt over to Syria, and now it backfires. And they're heavily taxed. And here's Syria, and they need these installment payments, 1,000 talents every year for 12 years. And historians tell us that they had done this for 11 years and had one payment left. That balloon payment, we would call it here, right? Have you ever been there? Oh, I got one payment left. But there was just no money left. And so we find here that Seleucus IV does something very desperate. And it backfires. And it costs him his life. And I wish I had time to explain it to you. But we're out of time. So we'll leave you hanging here until next time. Same bat time, same bat channel. No, just kidding.
You've been listening to Pastor Tony Skeving of the Fargo Baptist Church in Fargo, North Dakota. If you would like a CD of today's message, you can obtain one by sending a gift of $2 to Fargo Baptist Church, 3303 23rd Avenue South, Fargo, North Dakota, 58103. That address again, Fargo Baptist Church, 3303 23rd Avenue South, Fargo, North Dakota, 58103. We hope you'll join Pastor Skeving next time right here on Pulpit Power. Pulpit Power is a production of Heaven 88.7.